We call to order. The first item of business today is a work session on 2101. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2101 comes to you from the governor, and it creates the Oregon Homeland Security Department.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2101 be moved to the full committee with a recommended referral to the State and Federal Affairs Committee.
Okay. Any comments or discussion?
Take the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Yeah, that'll be moved to the committee tomorrow. And then we'll be in recess. Committee will be in recess until 9:15. Well, I call to order. First item up today is a public hearing on Senate Bill 914A. Mr. O'Leary.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 914A comes to you from the Criminal Justice Commission. This would direct the Department of Corrections to establish uniform pre-sentence report forms that would require the report writers to provide an analysis of what disposition is most likely to reduce the offender's criminal conduct. It would also be required that the writer provide an assessment of the availability of any relevant programs available to the offender, either in or out of custody, whether DOC-sponsored programs or not. The measure is intended to apply principles of crime reduction in sentencing decisions, and it passed the Senate 25-0 with 5 excused.
Thank you. Judge Marcus and Scott Taylor, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Michael Marcus. I'm a trial judge in Multnomah County. This is my 16th year on the bench. I was closely following the work of the Public Safety Review Steering Committee and the Sentence Imposition Task Force of the Adult Sentencing Subcommittee of the Public Safety Review Steering Committee. This bill and 914 before you this morning are two of the proposals that I brought to the committee that were adopted by the committee and have passed out of the Senate. They address a critical failure, in my view, in our criminal justice system. A police officer will bring an application for warrant to my home at 3 in the morning. I do a lot of the warrants in Multnomah County. The prosecutor will work up the case. A jury will hear it. A defendant will get convicted. And then we sentence the defendant. Most defendants who are sentenced for most crimes will commit a new crime after they're sentenced. When we start looking at the statistics, they become tremendously alarming. There's one that stands out in my mind from July of 2000 in Portland. Of the 23 people jailed for robbery in that month in Portland, 22 of the 23 had been in the same jail within the prior 12 months. We have a tremendous problem of recidivism. I know Mr. Taylor's here from Department of Corrections, and I hate to embarrass a colleague, but Department of Corrections will tell you recidivism is 30%, and that's because they don't count misdemeanors, which constitute 75-80% of the crime. The actual recidivism rate is around 62%. When the governor charged this Public Safety Review Steering Committee, he said that we should review, or it should review, criminal justice in Oregon to see if it adequately serves the safety of the people of Oregon. The biggest problem in criminal justice is that when they come to sentencing, judges do not are not expected to and do not routinely examine the issue what disposition is most likely to reduce criminal behavior. This bill would do what we've done in Multnomah County statewide, which is in those few cases that have pre-sentence investigations, ask the writer to address the very issue. What disposition available to the judge is most likely to reduce criminal behavior? Is it incapacitation? Is it a program? If it's a program in or out of custody, which program is actually available to the offender? So this would provide additional information. We've been using the resulting PSIs in Multnomah County for 2 years, and I think it's, as far as I know, it's the consensus among my colleagues on the Multnomah bench that it makes, I'm sorry, are we on 919? For 914?
914.
Okay, I'm looking at my testimony for 914, but I'm talking about 919. I am talking about 914. The pre-sentence investigation has become tremendously more useful to us. I believe that's the consensus of all of the colleagues I have on the bench in Multnomah County, and I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Chief of Community Corrections for the Department of Corrections. I'm also here today representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. Just in support of this bill, we've talked to Judge Marcus. We've had some discussions internally about what it might or might not do. As far as our workload, we believe that what it will do is move us more towards the whole evidence-based practice that we've been working on for the last few years. And the Department of Corrections is ready to meet with a group of practitioners to redesign the format to allow for comments in the two areas that laid out in the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, you mentioned evidence-based practice. Are you using then the data or the window kind of what Multnomah County's done in this past 2 years?
Chair Barker, Representative Wilson, when Multnomah County does those pre-sentences, they move with the guys occasionally, so we've seen them around the state. We are not at this point everywhere around the state using that information, and because of the reduction in the number of pre-sentences ordered in a variety of counties, it's a much smaller number. But we've been out training on evidence-based practices. We've been talking about how to start putting this material in a report and using it. This gives us a format.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the questions, Mr.
Rose. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Marcus, is there a pre-sentence report that's done on offenders who are convicted of Measure 11 sentences?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, often, because ballot Measure 11 just establishes a floor, and the last pre-sentence investigation I had actually was a day in which I had one that was ballot Measure 11, one that was not. It is very helpful often in determining whether to impose consecutive ballot Measure 11 sentences, and there are certainly cases in which upward departure is available, notwithstanding the floor that ballot Measure 11 applies. So the short answer is yes. Not all ballot Measure 11 sentences, but there are many sentencing occasions where we have more than one count and the opportunity to do something. There's still quite a range of discretion above the floor that ballot Measure 11 establishes.
Further, Mr. Chair, if I could, there's been some analysis been shared with me that indicates that at a certain point in duration for certain kinds of offenses, that the longer the incarceration, perhaps the worse the result in terms of recidivism. Would that issue be addressed in as to offenses that are subject to a mandatory minimum?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, yeah, absolutely. That is one of the issues that we need to address. On that question, and we may have the same issue in 919, the interesting dichotomy is very frustrating. There are strong and well-intended voices, both of them evidence-based because they like to look at their own evidence. Many sentences for many people increase the recidivism after the period of incarceration. Most people who write and argue about that impact ignore what happens during incarceration, which is for the period of incarceration, there's no crime on the outside. Unfortunately, most of the people who promote incarceration for its own sake refuse to acknowledge that after people get out, they often do more harm than they would have in the period after they get out. What we need to do, and what we've done in Multnomah County to some large extent, is put both things on the same test. That is, how much crime reduction are we accomplishing over the career of this offender? And precisely, that would be an issue that a good pre-sentence investigation should investigate when we have a limited amount of incarceration available and some choices about how to use the range of incarceration available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? The only thing I have to say is I can't believe it's been 16 years since you heard your ads with the bell ringing and when you first ran for a judge. You're making me feel old. I think it's been 16 years.
Let me tell you about how it is to have a 40-year-old daughter.
Representative Thatcher?
Just for an example, could you give me... give some examples of dispositions that you would use in this pre-sentencing investigation? In other words, what kind of what types of reports or examples would you see in the report making suggestions for? I mean, just wondering.
Sure, Representative Barker. Representative Thatcher, Chair Barker. The protocol is different where I work. Sorry. The day I referred to, I had two PSIs. One was in a persistent property offender with limited prison available in terms of time, and he was on the cusp between probation and treatment. The PSI, which was prepared along these protocols, did a variety of things. It addressed the question of whether drug treatment was likely to work with this offender, where drug treatment was available in CRCI, or where it was available in the community, the difference between secure treatment and non-secure treatment, inpatient and outpatient, and what we could accomplish with prison and not. In the past, before we made this change in Multnomah County, they wouldn't talk about that. And that's a very critical factor, because the most difficult offenders to deal with are the ones for whom we do not have adequate prison space, who are repeat property offenders with drug problems. So understanding who among them is most likely to get treatment and where, getting a source of information about what the waiting list is at CRCI for Turning Point, who's likely to succeed from that program in terms of not committing a crime, as compared with local time and local programs and how they're backed up and how successful they are. That's information that's critical. On the other end of the spectrum, I had a ballot measure 11 case in which the question was, should there be repeated sentences, consecutive sentences, or should they all be at the same time? And there what I got was an analysis of both psychological analysis and analysis of how likely it was that this person would continue to be a threat of physical harm to people, notwithstanding a period of incarceration. Those are both examples of a discussion that the PSI would not mention before, because the PSI before would simply go through. I'm afraid that's my cell phone. I'm so sorry.
Everybody's checking. You're not.
Just to relieve everybody else of the burden, I'm guilty.
Thank you.
That's why I hand people the gavel in my courtroom when I have a problem. In the past, the PSI would do a wonderful job of gathering background information, criminal history, procreational history, marital history, drug history, mental health history, employment history, guidelines as they apply, and then recommend a sentence in terms of what's deserved. And as everybody who looks at this program understands, the program being criminal justice, what's deserved is a terribly wide spectrum. It can start very high depending on the nature of the crime, but what's deserved is a pretty wide range of things. And the question is, within what's deserved, what should we do and why? And that's never been part of PSIs until we've made this change in Multnomah County, and we found it very beneficial. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, it did. It gave me a lot of information I was curious about. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
Are we in a work session now?
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 914A be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Are there any discussion? Is there any discussion? Take the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
McPherson. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative McPherson, you carry that, please?
Sure.
I don't have the. I just put it in the sheet because I need to. Yeah. Thank you. Judge Marcus again, please. And we'll open the Public hearing on Senate Bill 919A. Mr. O'Leary.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 919A would direct the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to conduct a study of the feasibility of incorporating consideration of reduction of criminal behavior and reduction of crime rate into the Oregon felony sentencing guidelines. Currently, the felony sentencing guidelines in Oregon do not say anything about reduction of criminal behavior or reduction of crime rate. This would allow the Criminal Justice Commission to use its staff and resources to look at that issue and determine whether or not that can be a consideration that would be implemented into the sentencing guidelines. The measure passed the Senate 23-4 with one excused. And out of the Speaker's office, I should mention that this measure came with a subsequent referral to what was then Joint Ways and Means and what would now have to be the House Budget Committee.
Okay, and I believe we're working on to see if that's necessary. Is that right at this time?
Chair Barker, that is correct. I yesterday, when preparing the bill, had a conversation with John Borden at Legislative Fiscal, who prepared a fiscal statement of this measure on the Senate side. The reason for the fiscal statement being issued, by the way, the fiscal statement does not actually lists that there will be a fiscal impact. The fiscal statement was written out of LFO's concern that there was this line in the bill that says that the Criminal Justice Commission will use its staff and resources to conduct the study. And I talked to John Gordon about that issue and about whether or not LFO felt it was necessary to have this subsequently referred. And John Borden represented to me that they did not. I also spoke with Craig Prinz, the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission, who's present in the gallery, and Mr. Prinz advised me that he anticipates that the Criminal Justice Commission would be able to conduct the tasks required of this bill within their current budget without any additional expenditure. Based on that, if the committee directs me, I'm prepared to do a letter to the Speaker asking for a rescind and subsequent referral.
Okay, and we'll after we hear testimony, we'll probably do that because we're getting late in the game here. Things that go to other committees sometimes disappear for two more years. So, Judge, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Michael Marcus, a trial judge in Multnomah County. Continuing the same discussion from 914, this was another of the proposals that I brought to the governor's committee, and it was approved. On the same issue, we have laws dating from the 1971 criminal code revision and from the 1996 revision to Article 1, Section 15, spearheaded by Crime Victims United. The purposes of sentencing have to do with public safety. Notwithstanding the law that preceded and followed the adoption of the sentencing guidelines, law that says public safety, crime reduction, protecting against crime is the purpose of sentencing, or at least a major purpose, the sentencing guidelines have nothing intentionally to do with crime reduction. I have my own views on what they represent politically and where they came from, but their primary author is Hardy Myers. He agrees that they have nothing intentionally to do with crime reduction. They're not designed to propose the presumptive sentence that is most likely to result in the reduction of crime by the offender. They have, by unintended consequences, very roughly that function, because they do prescribe a higher sentence for an offender with a worse crime and a worse record. But they do it, again, accidentally. That's not how they're structured. They're not structured to reduce crime. They're structured to order the use of prison beds on the notion that it makes sense to prescribe blocks of appropriate accountability or just deserts. This bill would simply charge the Criminal Justice Commission with the task of exploring whether it is possible to have guidelines propose sentences or encourage sentences that actually work to reduce crime. And the idea, of course, is not to abandon what the guidelines do accomplish, which is predictability of resource and some lack of disparity in sentencing, but to see if they could also, at the same time, try to further public safety, which is generally not part of the picture at sentencing. So I urge your support of this bill. I do have some insight on the language that is the basis of the subsequent referral, and that is that the language requiring the commission to use its own resources was required to achieve the concurrence of Crime Victims United in the bill, because they feared that if the commission were to subcontract, the contractor might be PSU's Criminal Justice Research Institute, which they view as biased. In fact, I had to struggle with legislative counsel who took that language out of the bill to put it back in to maintain their concurrence. But they support the bill. As far as I know, it has no opposition from the... Well, I don't know of any opposition to the bill. I remember one of these two bills had a negative vote on the committee, that the governor's committee, and that negative vote was for the proposition that judges should not be in the business of predicting future dangerousness, which is at the heart of this dispute. And this dispute is one that is quietly characterizing criminal justice in our country and the Western world, and that is, are we supposed to be doing crime reduction or not with sentencing discretion? And I think Oregon has in its constitution and in its statutes clearly made the decision that judges are supposed to be doing crime reduction, so why don't the guidelines help us instead of hinder us?
Okay, great. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Marcus, I'm curious. Are you familiar, are you aware of any other states in the country right now that have looked at what you're proposing here?
One state has broken out of the distinction between guidelines and crime reduction, and that is the state of Virginia. And I cite that in my written testimony. They have a website where you can get all of their written material. What they did was create their own study, their own determination of whether there was, in their case, a risk assessment instrument that would help them more accurately categorize who should be doing more time, who should be doing less time. Their first target was sex offenders, and by use of an instrument which they validated through their own studies to everyone's satisfaction, they altered the guidelines so as to increase the sentences for sex offenders most at risk of doing more harm. And I think they as much as doubled the presumptive sentence for sex offenders who are at higher risk. And that again is all cited, and they have reports which are available. I have not personally validated any of that. It is a state that has made a serious attempt and is reportedly repeatedly happy with what it's produced in terms of longer time for people who are at greater risk of doing more harm and more alternative sentencing for people for whom that's effective in a risk assessment device. It's an attempt to bring science to this process, a process which is really been irresponsible in modern times to the extent that we have avoided science at this critical phase between all of this work to get somebody convicted, all of this money in corrections, and we have discretion to screw it up, and very little attention to make it work as best as it can at the time of sentencing.
Follow-up. Just kind of, you know, now that we've talked a little bit about the state of Virginia and that you've brought this up, I'm also, I'd be curious to know, when was this... research conducted, when was it implemented, and are you familiar with any of the results so far for measurement on that?
The material that I cite, I think it's been over a period of 4 years in Virginia. The 2004 annual report is the most recent that's on their website that details, it reviews the implementation over the course of the years, the first application to sex offenders and the gradual increase of the areas. They're very happy with it. I'm reluctant to go into the process with the committee. I understand that the bill calls for the creation of a committee much like the one that was the Public Safety Review Steering Committee, representatives of major players. And I don't want to go in there with an agenda of what we should do, because it's going to be a political process. I need people to agree that there are things that we all agree would improve the guidelines in terms of public safety impact on sentencing. But I'm excited about the Virginia project, because it is a responsible, well-thought-out, well-planned, well-researched, and apparently successful effort at making guidelines seek public safety. Nobody else has done it, as far as I know.
Okay. Further questions?
I do have questions.
Representative Thatcher.
Sounds like this study would
be approximately a year and a half if we reported back to the next legislative assembly. Do you anticipate it would be completed by then, only in a year and a half, or would you continue it?
Chair Parker, Representative Thatcher. If we open this door towards making the function of the Criminal Justice Commission in reviewing the guidelines one of seeing how guidelines can encourage sentences that work to protect the public, it's a door that will never close. As in Virginia, they started with one project, took some years, and they started doing sentencing under the guidelines that I think are at least attempting seriously to address public safety. Once we do that, the flow of increased information about what it is that works on which offenders as new programs are developed, I would consider it to be a persistent part of the charge of the Criminal Justice Commission. Its charge now is to review the guidelines, propose review amendments, and so forth, mounted to regulations that govern them. And I would assume in a healthy world that that would include ensuring the best practices we can achieve to accomplish public safety within the other purposes of sentencing under the guidelines. So it would never be over as long as there was crime.
Yeah, a year and a half doesn't seem like very long to say, ooh, okay, this way it is. Now, I'm wondering who would be participating in the study. Would it be a statewide, where you'd have all the corrections facilities participating in this?
There is a statutory committee authorization under the sentencing, under the Criminal Justice Commission authorizing statutes. They would constitute a committee which would include representatives from law enforcement, from prosecution, from defense. Crime Victims United would be there. Judges would be there. Local probation would be there. And the committee would have to decide how to proceed under the structure of the Criminal Justice Commission, using its own resources was A, political, and B, fiscally required. Nobody's going to fund this effort to start with in the current economic climate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, Representative Thatcher, good questions on how long it would take to do this and those type of things, functionally how we'll do it. And just to note, Representative Olson is the House appointee to the Criminal Justice Commission, which is a non-voting member, but I'm very hopeful that he would take an active part in this because I think it's a very important study. To do this, the Virginia study that Judge Marcus talked about, the reason you didn't want to get into it is it's complicated statistics, which I'm going to be taking a class at Willamette to help me understand. But the simple way to look at it is they take inmates and they look at them by dividing them into demographics by their age, by whether they're married or not, their criminal, you know, more than just their criminal history, and they compare those populations and look at which ones in the past were more likely to reoffend, and then they put that into their sentencing structure. So to do this, we would have to use the Criminal Justice Commission, and the phrase that I didn't bring the bill with me, but the phrase that says we would have to use our own staff resources. I would use our resources to have the committee and do the hearings, but we would also need to use Department of Corrections. They have analysts that are able to do and have done that type of analysis of their populations. But I think the key is, and Judge Marcus said it properly, that the concern was that we don't contract it out to someone else and just say, tell us what you think. This needs to be a dialogue between those that, as again Judge Marcus said, this is a national debate on how you do this. Virginia's one side. There are also folks that think that this is impossible to predict and no one should be doing it. So I think it really should be a study of, one, what Virginia does, get input from around the nation on you know, both sides. That's what commissions and forums are for, to hear both sides. And I would use, in our statutes, we can ask different agencies to come in, and I think we would really need a lot of help from corrections, because they have the analysts, and obviously it's their population that we would be looking at the history of, and then making recommendations. I think we could do it in a year and a half, and we could get a long ways toward that. I think it fits into the general scheme of what the commission should be doing. And if you'll recall, in January or February, when I had that Senate Bill 124 that I came in with, and I said, these are the rules that we've amended, and here we ask for you to approve them, those rules were incredibly reactionary to what you, the legislature, had done. Meaning, when you had a new crime, we would just take that crime and say, let's compare it to other crimes and we'll make it an 8. This is more this type of thing, looking at sentencing in general and having a policy discussion during the interim. This is more what I believe that you want as a legislature, what you want the commission to do. And it's more in line with what the governor wants it to do, not be reactionary, but proactive. And so it kind of fits along the lines of what I hope we'll be doing anyways.
One more, and I kind of heard you say this, but I want to make sure I'm understanding that we're not creating a new bureaucracy, so to speak, in doing this. This is going to be utilizing the resources that are currently in place to do what probably you should be doing anyway. Okay.
Representative Thatcher, Chair Barker, I don't have a bureaucracy.
Used to be in the courts, too.
Well, you know what I mean.
We go backwards. I often do a Your Honor every once in a while, too, but I don't have a bureaucracy. With the loss of the folks in my office that do the juvenile crime prevention grants, which monitor state and federal grants to the local courts and counties to reduce crime prevention, I'm going to probably have 5 people in my whole commission. That's to administer the sentencing guidelines, do the asset forfeiture oversight committee, administer the racial profiling committee. So I don't have people to do this right now, but my commitment is taking what I do have and focusing it on a proactive plan. So no, there will not be a bureaucracy. What I plan on doing is taking the power I have in the statute to cooperate with other agencies, bring them in, and work it that way.
One more, thank you.
Please.
Who would be doing the study? I didn't quite understand. Did you take out PSU from that as perform the study, or are they back in there as doing the study?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, here's what I envision: is the commission would had charged me to bring in the Virginia information that Representative Olson was asking about. I've already read some of that report. I would bring in the research analysts at DOC who could explain it, because it's a regression analysis comparing different populations. We'd look at what Virginia has done and what impacts that has had on recidivism. And then we would also ask the counterpoint to there's also the other side that says, you can't predict who's going to reoffend. You have no way to do that. And there are those experts nationally that would do that. I would see if I could bring them in. If I can't bring them in, I would bring in their reports and have my staff present them to the commission, to this committee within the commission. They would have a dialogue about it. They would vote on it at some point on how, if they wanted to change the sentencing guidelines, how they would. And then that would go to the commission itself, which is 7 appointees from the governor's office, 1 from the House, 1 from the Senate, who are non-voting. They would vote on whether to approve that. It would come to you next session, and you'd have to approve it to make it law. So that's my vision of how we would do this.
Okay. I just have one comment left. Not a question, however. I would just be concerned that we balance the crime reduction study, the scientific, this population would be less likely to reoffend with this small sentence, even though maybe the crime committed would warrant, via perception and otherwise from the public, a much larger sentence. And I would just hope that would be taken into consideration too, and I guess it will be since you have Crime Victims United participating. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I think I would definitely want to as well. I was a prosecutor in Multnomah County. That's how I started my career. I very much care about accountability, and I think that's the tension that we all are trying to find, is you want to make sure defendants are accountable, and you also want to make sure that once they come out of prison, what we've done with their sentences and what we've done with our resources makes sense so that they don't reoffend when they come back into the community. So I think you're absolutely right. And that's the, incidentally, that's the tension that's in the Constitution and in the statutes. Accountability is part of it. Just deserts is part of it. Punishment is part of it. And also reducing crime. And finding that tension, you need to have many members, many voices, so that they're all represented. And I can assure you that I would make sure that Crime Victims United was a part of this process. And it would be important to have that there.
Thank you. And obviously, this is going to be several years because some of the census, I mean, you can't even begin to look at some of the results for a while, but it'll be great. And I'm pleased to see you're going to be using scientific principles, kind of unusual in today's government picture, instead of hocus pocus to figure this thing out.
Okay. I, Mr. Chair, I think it's all, I know, it is exciting because what we do, what you find is because the inmate population is so controlled and because we do an assessment when they come into the system, we know a lot about inmates demographically. And so it's a perfect area for doing statistical analysis because you have all that information. And then you can compare what happens after they get out. And so I think it is a long-term thing. I think it's a thing that we're, as you said, it's a process. It's kind of changing how we would look at sentencing and changing, for me personally, it's changing how the commission will function. I don't think anyone wants it to be reactionary. Everyone's telling me, be proactive, give us a plan, and so this would be part of that process.
Thank you. Yes, Judge.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a couple of comments. The Criminal Justice Commission has, per statute, produced a public safety plan. That public safety plan promotes, among other things, I think its first recommendation has to do with looking at data to see what's most effective in reducing crime. The tension is not so much between public safety and just deserts. Because when I proposed in 1997 House Bill 2229, Bob Kuhn sat by me in the committee that saw us sitting together and was, I think, impressed by the fact that we were sitting together and talking about the same bill, supporting the same bill. I was there because I heard Bob Kuhn say to a committee, a meeting of Crime Victims United Parents of Murdered Children, I had summoned the courage to go there to make my proposal to them. And I heard him say that the most important thing you can do for a victim is to prevent the next crime by the offender. The ballot measure that produced Article 1, Section 15 starts with safety of society as the first named principle of sentencing. In practice, in my experience as a judge, I've sentenced people for 15 years and more because I was a pro tem for 10 years before that, a few days a month. There are very, very few sentences in which the available range to the judge and the many choices are inconsistent with public safety. In my experience, what happens is there is some sense of what would be an excessive sentence, and within that, what we should be seeking is something that is most likely to protect the public. It may very well be incarceration. And there's more to use in a more serious crime because that limit goes up. In other words, it's not disproportionate if somebody's done some real harm to use a lot of time as an incapacitation. The crimes in which there's a real tension at the other end are actually rather few. There are social drinkers who, by the accident of circumstance, end up killing somebody with their car who are not chronic drunk drivers, who get out there, drink, and kill somebody. in fact, for public safety, for that person, putting aside general deterrence, it might be that a probationary sentence is appropriate. But obviously, for the victim's family, that's not going to be sufficient. There's also the victim of child sex abuse. If it's intrafamilial, we know that there are some ways of handling some sorts of sex offenders with safety outside of prison. We also know that there are many sex offenders that there's nothing we can do. But for intrafamilial opportunistic sex offenders, there are some that can be safely managed on probation. But that child needs, often, a very strong indication that the child was not to blame. And that's the role of severe sentencing. The actual tension is between doing our best to reduce crime and ignoring the responsibility for doing our best to reduce crime. That's the real tension, in my view. And we need to be responsible and accountable for best efforts to protect the community when we exercise our sentencing discretion. And this bill would help us in that direction.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Move to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 919A be moved to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, with it, we'll still leave in the referral to Joint Ways and Means until we get that moved. Any discussion? Roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Four ayes.
And Representative Olson carried that to the full committee. Thank you. You trade this for the last one? Yeah. You want to move or you can stay there?
Okay,
you
can
stay there.
It's pretty clear.
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 56A. Mr. Don Hefner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 56A would prohibit a person from operating a motorboat or idling that motorboat engine while any person holds onto or occupies any portion of the boat aft of transom. It does provide certain exceptions when that individual is docking, assisting in the docking or departure of a boat, exiting or entering the boat, or engaged in law enforcement activities, and it punishes by a maximum fine of $360.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We requested this bill in the interest of preventing injuries and deaths caused by carbon monoxide poisoning that have been documented when people engage in a sport that's sometimes referred to as teak surfing or platform dragging. This sport happens when people hold on to the swim platform of a ski boat. Sometimes those platforms are built of teak wood, hence the term teak surfing. The attached to my testimony is a letter from Captain Jane Brown McGammon of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention of NIOSH. That letter provides a thorough background regarding the nature of the problem and the need for Senate Bill 56. The CDC became involved in the issue of carbon monoxide poisonings involving teak surfing in 2001, and that was an outgrowth of work they were doing on CO deaths on houseboats and generators. In their studies, they documented 49 severe poisonings, with 17 resulting in death, 19 in loss of consciousness, occurred on swim platforms or while teak surfing. 1 in 4 of the poisonings took place while occupying a swim platform with the boat at idle, stationary in the water. As a little science background, carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin with an affinity 200 to 270 times greater than oxygen. With carboxyhemoglobin concentrations of 10 to 20%, symptoms of CO resemble those of motion sickness or heat exhaustion, include headache, nausea, dizziness, and vomiting. Seizures, coma, and death occur at carboxyhemoglobin concentrations above 30%. And they've measured carboxyhemoglobin concentrations exceeding 50% after minutes of open air exposure to boat exhaust. In one case that was documented in the CDC letter, it involves an 18-year-old boy who drowned after losing consciousness from CO poisoning while teak surfing on Lake Powell during a high school graduation party. He lost consciousness after 5 minutes of exposure while teak surfing, lost his grip from the swim platform, slipped under the water, and drowned. His body was recovered 3 days later, and his autopsy CO level indicated that more than 51% of his oxygen-carrying molecules had been replaced by carbon monoxide. The CO concentration in the airspace around that swim platform was measured at nearly 27,000 parts per million. The World Health Organization limit for exposure is 87 parts per million for 15 minutes. In another Lake Shasta case, an adult male died within minutes of simply resting on a swim platform with the boat at idle. His autopsy showed 89% of his oxygen-carrying molecules had been replaced by CO. There have been laws in other states enacted recently to address this problem, notably in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and most recently in California. Last year, the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators adopted a model act to address this issue. Our bill is based on that model act. It calls for a prohibition of teak surfing or platform dragging and will also prohibit temporary occupancy of the swim platform while the boat is at idle. There are exceptions for people ingressing and egressing a boat or docking. We reviewed this with the Water Sports Industry Association, the WSIA. Prior to introduction, there's a letter also attached to my testimony from them indicating their support for this. Fortunately, we have not documented any CO deaths in Oregon, at least so far, due to this problem. However, given the data from the CDC and accident reports from other states, it leads us to believe that we should be proactive in following their advice and industry recommendations. We believe the bill will promote safer boating practices. It will complement efforts by not only the industry and other volunteer organizations and our agency to educate and inform the public about the dangers of carbon monoxide and these unsafe practices. We intend to incorporate information on this onto our website, into publications, and, of course, marine officers who are encountering people in the field will also be explaining the dangers of CO to boaters on the water. This had a subsequent referral from the Water Committee. They gave it a unanimous or due pass recommendation, and we would ask for your consideration of this bill today. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm curious, Paul, have you had any discussion with the Sheriff's Association as well as with the state police, because they seem to be the majority of the ones who do the enforcement on marine activity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, we presented this information to Marine deputies last spring, and their eyes were popping out with this problem of CO poisoning. And the reason is that it's hard to believe that people could succumb to CO poisoning in an open-air situation, which is why it took CDC so long to figure out some of these deaths that were occurring. People that were young and healthy, otherwise healthy, dying while swimming, it didn't make sense until they managed to find the link to CO. So you look at the data and it's unbelievable. And we have the support of the sheriffs and enforcement officers to address this. We're also concerned from an occupational standpoint. I think many eyes were opened as well of the possible dangers to them due to prolonged exposure in that zone.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And my only concern at all is just to be sure that we can get the word out before they start really enforcing that hard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we try to stress education as a part of our enforcement efforts and having it on the law as something that is prohibited is a lot stronger than simply saying you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, I understand that. Anything further? Thank you. Move Senate Bill 56A to work session.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Move Senate Bill 56A to the full committee. There's no subsequent referral.
No.
Okay, with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Three ayes, one excuse.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll carry that one. Any other business before us today? Hearing none. Adjourned.